Good morning and welcome to Community Matters. My name is James Gage and I'm joined this morning by Dr. Dave Larson, who works for the Public Health Department at Syracuse University. Dr. Larson, we're so glad to have you here this morning. I wish we were talking about something a lot more pleasant, but with your expertise in public health, we wanted to have you come in and talk a little bit about the coronavirus epidemic that's sweeping our nation and the world. So first, let's start by asking you a little bit about yourself. How did you come to work in public health at Syracuse University?
So my background in public health goes back to my interest in malaria, and malaria is a mosquito-borne disease. I started studying that in 2007, did a master's of public health at Tulane University in New Orleans, and then did my PhD on strategies to eliminate malaria transmission in Zambia. Then got a job here at Syracuse University. I'm now an associate professor of public health here, and my research focuses on the control and epidemiology of infectious diseases, and primarily in lower-income countries where there's fewer resources, and then the spread and the distribution of disease fits right into my research expertise.
So spreading diseases, this is the thing you've been studying for years and years and years. This is the thing you educate other people on. This is the thing you go to other countries to explain and help to have public health officials understand.
Yeah, so I've presented at numerous ministries of health throughout sub-Saharan Africa. I presented at the World Health Organization, work with colleagues from the CDC, the Centers of Disease Control. I've published in scientific journals on these concepts. This is my first encounter with the family of viruses of coronavirus, coronavirus is a family of viruses that has been understudied and underappreciated, and so there are very few, maybe four or five coronavirus epidemiologists in the world.
So I'm glad you bring that up, because we hear coronavirus, COVID-19, there's different names for what's happening right now. What exactly is, as far as my understanding goes, a coronavirus? It's not necessarily this is the coronavirus.
So a coronavirus refers to a family of viruses. And when you look at them under the microscope, they have a cell that's kind of round, and then it looks like a halo or a crown on the outside of them that are the little protein little knobby things that stick out of the pictures, if you see the pictures on the CDC website. And so it's a family of viruses. There are a number of viruses that circulate within our populations today. And so our kids will have coronaviruses that cause the common cold, and that's normal. And then there's a few coronaviruses that circulate in animals that have made the jump from the animals' populations into the human populations over the last 15 years. And that includes SARS in the early 2000s and MERS. And those had a high fatality rate, and then they were quickly controlled. And then this new virus, which is the name of the virus, is SARS-CoV-2, and then it causes the COVID-19 disease. And so that's where we are today.
Is that the case with this particular virus, that it jumped from the animal kingdom to humans?
Yeah, so all the data and science suggests that this is what's called a zoonotic event, where you have a pathogen or a virus that affects animals, and then it jumps over to the human system. And there's some mutations that have to occur to allow for that to allow that virus to spread human to human. And those have occurred with this virus. And so the thinking right now is currently that it looks like it's come from the bat and then perhaps into an animal called the pangolin. I call this virus the revenge of the pangolin, because that's the most trafficked animal in the world, and humans have almost brought that animal to extinction.
Interesting.
And so those animals are in the markets in China. They're held in close quarters with each other, which allows for the exchange of viruses and recombining of viruses, and then it jumps over into humans. And this is how other viruses work. Influenza is similar. So influenza that affects us recombines in birds and pigs and humans, and that's why we get mutations every year. And this coronavirus, it looks like it's come from the animal system.
So one of the other names for this is the Wuhan flu, because from what my understanding is, and help correct me if I'm wrong here, that the source of this might have started in the Wuhan province of China. Is that accurate, or is that just where it was first sort of discovered?
Yeah, it looks like the initial transmission events going from the animal system to the humans occurred in Wuhan City in Hubei Province. It's not accurate to refer to it as the flu, because influenza is a separate family of viruses. And then we've moved away from naming viruses after locations. You know, we don't want to have like the Syracuse or the Rome flu or something like that. And so we moved away from that, and so we call it SARS-CoV-2.
Of course, that's not as catchy a name as coronavirus. So
yeah, coronavirus works. You know, I think if you say coronavirus, people know what you're talking about, and it is scientifically accurate. And so coronavirus is good. COVID-19 is fine. But I wouldn't call this the Wuhan flu. That's not a good name for it.
So what you said before about how this being a family of viruses, children have had coronaviruses. Common cold is a form of a coronavirus, or can be. What is it that makes this particular coronavirus scary?
So there's two aspects. With any infectious disease, there are two major issues that you need to look at to think about how scary they are. The first is how deadly they are. And not just deadly, but also how much severe illness this causes. It appears that this virus is pretty deadly in older populations, and then also with a significant percent that get really sick, even in younger populations down to age 40 to age 30. And so the highest mortality rates we're seeing are above age 60, and then but there's also hospitalization and intensive care for younger adults. So that's one aspect that makes this scary. The second issue is how easily the pathogen transmits from human to human. And so with a virus like Ebola, where its case fatality rate is about 50%. So if you get Ebola, you flip a coin and heads you're dead, tails you're alive. Hmm. Right? It's one of the most virulent diseases that is known to affect humans. And so that one is scary because of its case fatality, but it doesn't spread very easily. And so for epidemiologists, we're not as concerned about that type of virus because of it. It's easier to contain and it's more localized transmission. But when you have something as contagious as coronavirus or influenza, then we start to get concerned. Even with smaller case fatality rates like 2%, 3%, that's still large numbers of deaths and hospitalizations as it spreads throughout large populations.
So is that really the thing that's most concerning, is how quickly it spreads and how quickly it has been spreading without sort of getting ahead of it? When we know flu season's coming up, we can go and we can get a shot. But it seems like this sort of waved into the world population without having any kind of heads up on what was to be expected.
Yeah. So we had the first transmission of this virus is December of 2019, mid-December 2019. And it's a slow growth through January, and then an exponential growth, but it's, you know, starts slowly and then it grows exponentially. And started to see importations or exportations of virus in mid-January outside of Hubei province. Hard hit areas have been South Korea, Italy, Iran, and now the US. And so there's not a vaccine for this, and so that does add to the concern that this will spread.
So we've seen a lot of concern in the United States. You've just brought up the US as a place that's been sort of hard hit here. We've seen some precautions already in several states, including New York State's declared a state of emergency over the last couple of days here. We've seen Syracuse University in our area already say, nay, we're not doing classes anymore. We're going to start doing classes via online learning. Even larger universities, Harvard University, other places, are starting to take this precaution of saying, let's not gather together. Is that going to sort of stem the tide, just sort of not being in large groups?
What we're trying to accomplish with decreasing mass gatherings is to decrease the rate of spread. And so it's, if we get a quick spread through a community, we could quickly overwhelm the health workers and the health centers. And we don't want to be in a position where doctors and nurses are having to decide who gets the ventilator when somebody needs the ventilation to maintain their breathing and keep them alive as they recover from this. And recovery time for this virus could be upwards of 30 days if it's a severe case. And so we're trying to what's called flatten the curve or the peak, whereas this spreads exponentially. You get a sharp uptick of cases in a relatively short amount of time. And if you can decrease that spread, you can flatten that peak, and then you still get a significant number of cases, but they're spread out over time, and you don't overwhelm the health system. And so that's what people are trying to do. Now, the declaration of state of emergency is preemptive. You want to declare a state of emergency before the crisis hits, because you want to be able to mobilize forces and funds, and it gives you more leeway to make quick decisions and to really go after control of the transmission. And so states of emergency are declared before. You know, if a hurricane's coming, you declare a state of emergency before it makes landfall. You don't want to be caught in a crisis and then declare a state of emergency. The universities have started to close around the U.S. One of the primary fears is the spring break period. So as the students, you know, and Syracuse University has about 15,000 students, and if they disperse throughout the country, the fear is that they bring back corona to the community.
Right.
And they seed the community with transmission. We would likely not see much severe disease in the student population because they're younger, and it looks like this affects older individuals. And so you could have silent transmission or unknown transmission and get to the point where there's a number of cases that just kind of spring up out of nowhere, and then the health officials would be scrambling to try to contain those chains of transmission.
I appreciate that you said that the state of emergency gets declared before it becomes a massive problem. I mean, we know that there are reports further downstate, New York City, slightly above that, right in the New Rochelle area. We've heard about what's happening there. But although there are no known cases in Madison County, in Oneida County, Onondaga County, is it still best, in your opinion, to try to do things differently, to sort of prevent what could become a bigger problem?
Maybe I can talk a little bit about the challenge in China and how the Chinese people and the Chinese government have addressed this epidemic. And so in Hubei province, they took some drastic public health measures. They closed off the province, so complete quarantine of a whole geographic area. Nobody could come in or out. And then they locked down the citizenship into their homes to quarantine and really fight that. Those measures were necessary because they had so much transmission ongoing in the province. Outside of that province, the Chinese people have voluntarily decrease their social contacts and decrease their social gatherings. It's the term social distancing. And so they've voluntarily done that. And that has allowed the Chinese CDC to identify, here's a case of coronavirus. We know that this person imported this somewhere. We know this person's contacts. They can follow up with those individuals
right.
and take appropriate measures. And so they haven't required large lockdowns of the entire country, just of the epicenter of this epidemic. Now, in the U.S., if we get behind this exponential growth of the coronavirus, and I think we're already behind in some areas, then it's going to be quite severe and quite a huge impact on our health system. And it's likely to affect, you know, most Americans in some capacity. If we can get in front of it, then we can allow the health departments to chase up the chains of transmission of coronavirus. And the way we get in front of that is we reduce our number of social contacts. If we can commute into work, or telecommute into work, that's a good thing. If there's a gathering that we can skip, that's a good thing. And so it comes to us as individuals to voluntarily distance ourselves from other individuals and try to decrease the contacts with others, because each contact carries with it a small probability of a transmission event of the virus.
Right. And I think along with what you're saying, I think we also have to learn to not be offended if somebody says, I can't attend that event right now. Please understand. I can't shake your hand right now. Whatever else the case might be, that we're trying to limit that social contact. I think we have to change that culture of being more understanding, that is helpful to avoid large gatherings, to avoid person-to-person contact. The Madison County Health Department's released a number of of documents here to sort of help people stay a little more safe. And they've given some suggestions on how you can be a little more careful. They suggest if you feel sick, stay home. Cover your cough, your sneeze with a tissue or your sleeve. Don't use your hands. If you become ill, contact your doctor first before visiting their office so that you can maybe describe your symptoms first before you arrive there. They've also talked about, now we've seen this in a lot of places, washing your hands. Washing your hands often with soap and water. There's a nationwide panic on hand sanitizer. It seems like all the hand sanitizer,
it's plenty of soap,
in the U.S. is gone.
It's plenty of soap, and soap works just as well as the alcohol-based hand sanitizer.
So I'm glad you said that.
Chlorine bleach also works really well, right? If you dilute chlorine bleach down to 0.5%, and that works on surfaces. And so you don't, you know, there's cleaning supplies that work fine that don't include Purell.
So washing your hands thoroughly, 20 seconds or more, seems to be the standard in what I've been reading. That's just as effective as using hand sanitizer.
Yes, yeah. So the outside of the coronavirus, it's a lipid bilayer, right? So it's these fat molecules that are on the outside of the coronavirus, and the soap disrupts that, gets in, kills the virus, and activates it, and so it's totally fine.
So just to be clear, if your house does not have hand sanitizer in it, you can still be safe.
Yeah, so my house doesn't have hand sanitizer. We use soap. We use soap and water, and then we'll use chlorine. We'll dilute chlorine down with water to 0.5% and put that on rags and wash surfaces with that. And so the alcohol-based stuff works as well. But I don't want to fight the crowds for the last bottle of Purell.
Right, right. So you're saying that washing your hands, cleaning your house thoroughly, these are good ideas.
Yeah, so the transmission that looks... From the science that I've seen, is it looks like the majority of transmission of this virus is through what's called a fomite or droplet, and so a droplet is larger little basically spit that comes out of our mouth as we're breathing or talking, and it gets onto surfaces and then hangs out on that surfaces up to like a week, maybe 9 days. So we're likely, if we get this virus, we're likely to pick that droplet or that fomite off a surface with our hand and then touch our face. So the cleaner we keep the surfaces and the less we touch our face is a good thing. The cleaner we keep our hands is a good thing. Masks can perhaps be bad, because if you have a mask, you're more likely to touch your face because it's itchy. And we have a shortage of face masks in this country. And the people that really need them are people that are getting coughed on directly or people who are ill. And so we need to save masks for healthcare workers, for first responders, and for people who have coughs. If the healthcare workers go down, you know, that's 30 days of a doctor being out of commission. And that would be detrimental to all of us.
So if you are sick, wash your hands. If you are sick, maybe a face mask. But if not, don't use one as a precautionary measure.
Yeah, so don't use face masks at this point as a precautionary measure. Save those for the health workers. If you are sick, then a face mask can be helpful to contain that virus within your sphere and not transmit it elsewhere.
Now, being an expert in public health, can you sort of give us an idea of how well prepared was the United States for this coming to our doors?
So infectious disease epidemiologists and global health experts understand that the risk of infectious disease epidemics to Americans, to the world, is constant and high. And there have been emerging infectious diseases over the last 100 years that have all caused concern and have caused quite a bit of death and disease throughout the world. Recently, we've had things such as Ebola and Zika, the H1N1 swine flu, and SARS and MERS. And for various reasons, those specific diseases did not threaten our region as much as coronavirus will. And I won't go into the specifics of each of those diseases, but those diseases cause a lot of death elsewhere, outside of our country. But coronavirus has the characteristics that it will threaten our region. Our federal government has underappreciated the threat of infectious disease for the last 30 years, you know, independent of party or political affiliation. Just the president and the Congress have not appreciated how risky these things can be, how disruptive they can be, and how important it is to prepare and to be ready for these. The West Africa Ebola epidemic that affected Liberia, Sierra Leone, and Guinea, that was 2013 to 2016, and that was a watershed moment for our government. At that point, there was a lot of convergence of opinions and thought and ideas that, yes, global health security is an important piece. Now, despite that, we saw decreasing funding for the CDC for emergency preparedness. We've seen that over the last 20 years, right? So just a decrease in preparedness. The current Trump administration, they reshuffled the government systems, so they took out the epidemic response team from the National Security Council and from the Department of Homeland Security as part of their decreasing the size of government push. And that decreased the ability to respond to these and increases the time to respond. And so we're not appreciating this. The CDC's budget is 1% of our military's budget. So the CDC's annual budget is about $7 billion. We spent $700 billion on our military last year. And when we think about disruption to American society, if the threat of infectious disease is higher than domestic terrorism, higher than foreign terrorism, and is higher than war, but we're just not funding it at levels that appreciate the risk and appreciate the severity of these issues. And so we need to get our priorities aligned with our risks.
Do you think that due to how the experience that we're having now with coronavirus, with COVID-19, that this will sort of be a wake-up call for some of our politicians who are in power to sort of say, maybe we should reshuffle some of the money. Maybe we should put better stopgaps in place so that we can get ahead of things like this in the future.
I would hope so. Our federal government around infectious disease has acted in a system of or a pattern of panic and neglect. So something happens. So H1N1, the swine flu happens, and it's spreading, and then there's a panic. They appropriate billions of dollars to fight it, and then they forget about it. Right, we have a declining trend of public health emergency preparedness funding, and then you have these spikes of panic. Ebola happens. You get $5 billion appropriated to the CDC to fight this. That lapsed last year in 2019. You get, they appropriated $8 billion to fight coronavirus. That's more than the annual budget. And next year, maybe, or 2 years after this is gone, I'm guess if they follow the pattern that's been established over the last 20 years, they will continue to neglect it. And so I hope that this is that wake-up call. And I hope that, and one thing that we can do as citizens is to, write our congresspeople and our senators and say, look, fund infectious disease surveillance, fund the CDC. Now, ideally, the CDC would have funding where they're looking at all the viruses in the world and all the animal systems and identifying which ones are more likely to jump to humans and then funding labs to come up with vaccine candidates and therapeutics candidates. And then when it does jump, we say, oh, wait, we're ahead of this. We got this, right? The funding levels aren't there. It would be a massive endeavor, but we just don't have the political will or organization to do it. And if one good thing that could come out of this is the appreciation for infectious disease and appropriate funding levels to try to keep our people safe and healthy.
So because we're maybe behind the curve a little bit here, because it's sort of growing exponentially and we are not getting ahead of it and capping that growth, do you think it's worth panicking about? Should we be panicking? Should we be buying toilet paper en masse?
I read about some guy that bought 12 years of toilet paper on accident.
On accident?
Yeah, it's miscalculated how much toilet paper he needed, and now he has a room full of toilet paper for the next 12 years. It's not a time to panic. The coronavirus is not an existential threat. Humanity has faced infectious disease epidemics since our inception. If you go back to the time before we have vaccines, like measles and diphtheria, pertussis, these infectious diseases would come in waves. They come in every 10 years, every 15 years. If we go back 150 years when we had malaria transmission in the country, every summer there would be malaria transmission in D.C. or in other low-lying areas, and the people that could get out would get out. And so humanity will soldier on. This is not an existential threat. We should be prepared. You know, the CDC recommends we have a month's worth of our medications on hand in case of disruptions, and we should have a few weeks' worth of provisions in case of disruptions. And that's the preparations that we should have. On the behavioral side, if we can decrease our number of social contacts and decrease large gatherings, then we can decrease the rate of growth of the virus and allow our health officials to get out in front of it to where they're containing transmission chains. And right now in this country, I'm guessing we have a number of uncontrolled transmission chains.
With the last few minutes we have here together, Dr. Larson, I'd like to ask you to sort of define a couple of things that are to just get thrown into the media, into social media, into every report that we see. There's a couple of words. First is pandemic. Could you explain what a pandemic is, and does this qualify?
So a pandemic refers to a single health condition, and in this case, infectious disease. And it means that we have sustained transmission on more than two continents. Now, we have sustained transmission in Asia. South Korea's got it. China's got it going down. We have it and Iran has it. We have it in Europe with Italy and other countries there. And we have it here in North America. And so I consider this to be a pandemic. The World Health Organization has not declared it to be a pandemic. It's still a epidemic of international concern. But we're likely headed toward pandemic levels.
Epidemic of international concern sounds like pandemic light.
it's the seed, right? So if you look at what could this become, there's this issue that, yeah, this is concerning for multiple countries. And so I don't know if they'll change this or classify this officially as a pandemic at any point. Right. In my mind it is, but I don't make the distinction or the declaration of that.
So the other thing I'd like you to help us understand better is quarantine. What exactly is a quarantine, and is that what we're really experiencing in the U.S.?
So quarantine is where you take an individual and you put them in a waiting pattern to make sure that they don't have a disease. And so if I go to New Rochelle, for example, and I go shake hands with all the citizens of New Rochelle, and I come back to Syracuse, I should put myself in quarantine where I don't come into contact with anybody for a few weeks. It looks like the majority of people develop symptoms within about a week, about 5 days with this coronavirus. And so the two-week period of quarantine is appropriate. Now, another way this is, and the quarantine is used to protect people who were not sick and to decrease the spread from somebody who is potentially sick. So somebody doesn't know that they're sick yet, they go into quarantine and wait. And then once they're confirmed not to be sick or not to have the virus, then they're out of quarantine.
Very good. Dr. Larson, in the last minute here, one last final question. If there was one thing in particular that people could really focus on to keep themselves safer and to better understand how to help keep other people safe, what would that one thing be?
The most effective thing is that social distancing, right? So decrease your contacts with people. Avoid large gatherings. Don't shake hands, you know. Sit a few feet away from each other. Do these things to try to decrease the spread within the community. And that'll allow our health officials to get in front of this and not overburden our health system.
Very good. Dr. Larson, thank you so much for joining us. We appreciate all of your candor, as well as everything that you know about this, sharing it with us.
Yeah, thank you. It's been my pleasure.